An update on the Zika virus.
Comparing skin antiseptic agents at cesarean delivery.
Does modifying surgical work hours have an impact on patient care?
And the British Medical Journal uncovers the use of a faulty device in a regulatory drug trial.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on February 5th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, of course, we have to start with the Zika virus. I've heard it also pronounced Zika virus, and some rather disturbing things, actually, one taking place in Texas.
Elizabeth, where would you like to start?
Well, let's start in Texas. Oops, a case of sexual transmission of the virus.
It's actually not the first reported sexual transmission. There had been one many years before, but it's obviously the first since this recent outbreak. It's now been declared a global health emergency. To remind our listeners, we reported on this several weeks ago with the associated Zika with birth defects, particularly microcephaly or small heads in children. What we didn't report at that time was there's also an increased incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome associated with that, a severe neurologic disease. There's now been cases reported in over 30 different countries, at least 50 cases in 13 states in the U.S. as well. There are rare instances where infected people have traveled back home and transmitted it to their partner via sexual transmission. Transmission probably through semen, less likely through saliva.
I don't think we're getting any real new information, though, with regard to precautions.
No, mosquito precautions are the best way of preventing the disease because, as we talked about, there's no treatment. A couple other new things. We're now recommending that people that have traveled to areas in which Zika is endemic not provide blood transfusions for at least 28 days. If you have gone to an area, is that you have protected intercourse for 28 days as well, because about 80% of the people who contract the disease actually don't manifest symptoms. The 20% that do may have a skin rash, some joint pain, conjunctivitis, that is watery, teary eyes. And then because most of this is centered in Brazil, there's some concern that this may interrupt the Olympics.
I guess we're going to have to get our arms around this issue of the Olympics. And fortunately, there's a little bit of lead time for that. I think we'll leave Zika for right now. We're certainly going to hear more about it, I have no doubt. Let's turn from here then to the New England Journal of Medicine, something that's made a bit of a splash in our world, that's in the medical world. The idea that by modifying surgical resident hours, patient care really is not harmed.
Several years ago, duty hours for residents, that is the number of hours a resident can work per week and how many hours they can work consecutively, 24 hours, plus four to check out of a hospital, and how much time they needed in between work periods, at least a 14-hour rest, are all very regimented. That's led to a significant disruption in the training programs. All of this took place because of concerns about residents being sleep deprived and knowing that people that are sleep deprived have more errors in their judgment. And even if they don't have errors in judgment at the hospital when they're leaving home, they're more likely to be involved in motor vehicle accidents. So all of these changes were made without any proof that it actually improved patient care or improved resident well-being. Over the last year, there's been a national cluster randomized pragmatic trial involving 117 general surgery resident programs in the United States, randomly assigned either to the current duty hour policies or to more flexible policies, the waived rules on the maximum shifts the residents could work and the time off between shifts. And then they looked at the outcomes of the patients over the next 30 days in terms of their postoperative death or serious complications and the resident perceptions and satisfactions. By using the more flexible hours, there was no decrement in patient safety. Patients did not have an increased risk of postoperative death or did not have an increased risk of serious complications. Flexible policies did not give greater dissatisfaction with the overall education quality. In fact, the residents under the flexible policies were less likely than those under the standard policies to perceive negative effects of the duty hour policies. So this suggests that more flexible hours may be just as good for patients and just as good for residents.
And I like this. I think it sounds more humane.
Well, it is. And I think it's more humane not only to the residents and the program directors, but to the patients as well. The residents that had more flexible hours were less likely to report leaving an operation and less likely to hand off the patient to another physician. And from a patient standpoint, that's got to be more satisfying.
Good news. Let's stay in the New England Journal of Medicine to something that you picked, and I really want to hear why you did. This was use of topical agents for disinfection when a woman is about to have a C-section.
Well, I picked it because after years of performing cardiac catheterization, where there were different types of topical agents, one an iodine alcohol combination and one chlorhexidine alcohol combination, I really never knew which was best. I mean, you kind of like the iodine color. It's kind of orange. You can see it on the skin. You can imagine it's working. The chlorhexidine is invisible. You can't see it, but it has several characteristics that suggest it, in fact, may be better. Now, why about C-sections? Well, cesarean delivery is the most common major surgical procedure among women in the United States. There are about 1.3 million of these procedures performed every year. And if women have a infection related to that, not only does it interfere with taking care of the child and breastfeeding, but it often results in the hospitalization, and the cost of that's about $3,500. So which of these two agents is best? They looked at over 1,140 patients who were enrolled to receive either chlorhexidine alcohol or providine alcohol solutions. And then they followed them for the next 30 days. And those that received the chlorhexidine alcohol group had about half the risk of having infection. And by the way, there was no difference with regard to adverse skin reactions. I think this is very practical.
Thank you for educating me on that. I agree with you that the iodine solutions are very dramatic and the chlorhexidine ones really aren't. I'm also wondering about expansion of this. And you've already identified one place for potential expansion in cardiac catheterization. To me, there's got to be a million of them all over the hospital.
Right. In fact, every time someone has any type of surgery, there's a topical antiseptic used prior to the procedure. Now, the downside is it's a little bit more expensive than the other. But again, if you're preventing an infection that costs $3,500 to treat, I think it's worth it.
Indeed. Let's turn then finally to the British Medical Journal, the uncovery, I'm going to say the purported uncovery of erroneous results relative to an anticoagulation agent. And it was because of a device that was used during the study.
So Elizabeth, you picked this one. Do you want to lead off as to why you did?
We talk an awful lot about anticoagulation agents and reversing them. And they clearly have a lot of impact in patient care. So the potential that this study was conducted erroneously looms large in patient care, as far as I'm concerned.
So this has to do with a trial called the ROCKET AF trial. It looked at rivaroxaban versus warfarin in people with atrial fibrillation. The end result of the study, which was published in 2011, suggested that rivaroxaban was not inferior to warfarin. And because rivaroxaban does not require continuous monitoring of the blood thinning as opposed to warfarin, as a result, it's oftentimes now used as the preferred agent. Recent data suggests that the agent that was used to monitor blood thinning in the warfarin group was a faulty agent, and that there was evidence of this even before the trial began, and that perhaps the pharmaceutical companies involved with the trial were aware of this and did not make this public. So it's cast the results into question by many individuals. Here are the major issues. Now that we have this data, if we take all of the individual patients and submit it to a third party to completely reanalyze the data, could they provide useful information and would it still show the same results? There were two companies involved in the trial, Johnson & Johnson and Bayer, and Harlan Krumholz, both a friend, Yale physician, who has really promulgated opening up studies so they can be analyzed by third parties so we can get the final answer, have requested all of the data be available for analysis, and Bayer is refusing to do so. Johnson & Johnson says, we would be happy to do that, but we only agreed to do that for studies from 2014 onward, not from previous studies.
And the authors just today actually published a refutation of the findings of this study.
You're right. So the authors published an analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine. The original report that we're talking about was reported in the British Medical Journal. What the British Medical Journal and what Harlan and others are calling for is not to have the same investigators report the data, but to have someone else look at the data. If the original reporting is in doubt, that leads into question whether they're unbiased or not. And the way, obviously, to mitigate that is to have a third party look at it.
For right now, what are your thoughts clinically? What should people do?
Well, one of the things I think that is clear is that these new agents that were allegedly didn't need monitoring, studies suggest that the monitoring can actually prevent some of the serious adverse bleeds, that is people that are over anticoagulated, and can prevent some of the people that have stroke that are under anticoagulated. So in the future, I'm going to think these newer agents that were allegedly better because they did need monitoring, we're going to find out they actually do need monitoring to make them safer.
More on this undoubtedly, as well as on the transparency of data. On that note, I'm going to talk about, believe it or not, the topical agents this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.